Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Back to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. It's Alexis and I were talking in some of the recordings that we did earlier today, although I think this episode will actually be published before some of the episodes that we did today. So our timeline and your timeline as a listener may differ. We were talking about today about which version of the What If Machine we were taking out. So we're taking out the big version of the What If Machine because along with Alexis, who's about to say something here, she's going to introduce who else we have, and then we'll get started on what the topic is. So Lex, say hi to the listeners and let us know who's with us today and sort of where we're going.
Yeah. Hi, guys. So not only do we have the two-seater What If Machine, but we have the one with the sidecar today because we are bringing along somebody who, if you've listened to the podcast for a while, you've gotten to know. We've actually brought him on in an official role now. That would be Chris Coppola. Hey, Chris. How are you?
Hi. I'm fine. How are you?
Pretty good. What did we decide your official role was? What was it?
There was instigator.
There we go. Chief instigator.
I actually love the fact, and this is why I sometimes wish, and we may graduate to this at some point, especially now that we've started to at least post the audios on YouTube. But what you can't see on the Zoom meeting here, by the way, Zoom, if you want to send us a check for doing a name drop there, we're more than happy with that. What you can't see is the background that Chris has on the Zoom meeting. Them look. In fact, Alexis can't even see it because of where she's situated here. But where are you sitting, Chris?
I am sitting in the war room.
In the war room, made famous by what particular movie?
Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove. So I think my favorite line, it's been a long time since I've seen that movie. I'm not even sure if Alexis has ever seen the movie. She's shaking her head no. But my favorite line from that, and there's a lot of great lines in that, is there's no fighting in the war room. So for those of you that are, just made me realize how much I miss Peter Sellers. We should do an episode on what if we had not lost Peter Sellers, because there's a lot to go to there. So as Chris was saying, as Alexis was saying, Chris, we're happy to have you back in your role as instigator, podcast secretary of state, but regular contributor, I guess, is the official role. So going to be doing this more frequently. And now I'm going to have to find clever backgrounds to use on the Zoom meetings now that Chris is up the game here on the podcast, which was why we brought him on board, because we knew he would up the game here on the podcast.
Not only that, it gets back to my favorite quote from Dr. Strangelove. It can easily be accomplished with a computer.
Actually, again, just going down the path here, the image that pops into my head every time I think of Dr. Strangelove is Slim Pickens. Yeah, Slim Pickens plays the it's Slim Pickens writing the bomb down, and at some point in there, when he's talking about like the checklist, he has like it's a combination. Is it combination Bible Russian phrase book? Is that
yes?
Yeah, is that the line? Yeah.
Yes.
Now I'm nostalgic for Dr. Strangelove, so I'm going to have to take care of that little hankering here during the holiday season. So, Chris, thanks for joining us. We're talking off podcast, getting ready for the podcast here. This is going to be a little bit different, so we're going to be feeling our way through what we're doing here. And so, in almost every episode, we encourage our listeners to give us ideas for episodes, and listeners have started to do that. That's the wonderful thing. We don't have to come up with this stuff all by ourselves. And so,
to be fair, that's how I got into this.
That's exactly right. And so one of our listeners, Jacob Itzehov, actually submitted, this is a topical suggestion back, I guess it was either in late November or early December. And I'm just going to read what it is to set up what we're responding to, and then we'll get off into that, and we'll stop here for the break in a little bit. But he basically asked if it would be possible for us to focus an episode of A Fork in Time on what would have happened had the Eisenhower administration, the U.S. Eisenhower administration, not pressured the English, the French, and the Israelis to back down or back out during the Suez Crisis. Actually, I guess that was in 56, if I'm thinking correctly with my dates. And so his question is, how might a possible European domination of the Suez, again, assuming that the Israelis and that the English and the French would have prevailed, and what would have happened there, and had not been for the Eisenhower administration intervention, how might that have changed essentially what happens moving forward, prevented Egypt from closing the Straits in 67, the other time that there was disruption of the Suez traffic, and then, you know, how that might have played into the Six-Day War and other conflicts as well, and how might that have adjusted the working relationship between all the parties involved, but particularly Israel, along with the British and the French. So we were asked to sort of go down this path and look at historical what if, our fork there. And then he was also interested in seeing how this would have played out in Egyptian politics. And I think Chris is going to be able to give us a lot of insight into that just from the conversations that we were having before we started and how that might have changed the future there. So this is our first foray down listener suggested topic. The listener is not on to talk about their own topic. So we're going to have to make some assumptions here, but also sort of exploring that. So one of the first questions that we had, Chris, and I'll let you take over from this. We were trying to figure out what the fork might be, right? So you came up with a couple of different ideas. So let's set that up with some of the potential forks. Then we'll take the break and come back and walk it through.
So the first fork would be active U.S. involvement. Basically, the United States actually contributes troops because during the lead up to this, the United States had been consulted, had been asked to at least provide some sort of approval. And if you've got kind of a more gung-ho U.S., what does that do? The other, one of the other forks would be basically the U.S., you know, says naughty, naughty, naughty imperialist, but we'll accept the fait accompli because we kind of need Suez, we need the canal open, and we're not going to help put the economic pressure on you. What the United States wound up threatening was selling off British pound bonds and almost tanking the British economy because they thumbed their noses at us and went ahead anyway. So what if the United States tacitly accepts the military action taken by the United Kingdom, France, and Israel? And then finally, my take on this is, what if the United States partners with Great Britain and Israel, and okay, let's throw France into there too, and instead of taking overt military action, decides to do covert operations to destabilize and eventually remove the Nasser regime, which leads to the opening of the canal.
Right. So the three choices are actively support, sort of passively just allow, not do anything, but and then the other is go in an entirely different direction, which is along regime change and destabilization of the Egyptian government as being another way to accomplish the same thing. So having sort of set up those three potential ways that we might look at this, we're going to talk about this when we come back from the break. And so we'll do that here and sort of walk down each one of those and see where it leads us. I actually think it's probably a good idea just maybe for some of our listeners for us to do a little, when we come back, a little quick 1 or 2 minute recap about what the crisis is and why it's even there. I think it's pretty familiar. I mean, as we were talking about off podcast, it showed up in The Crown and it was referenced in a Billy Joel song. And we didn't start the fire. So for me, you've got all the background that you ever need if you've got those two things covered, but it's probably not a bad idea for us to pick it back up when we get back. So we'll be back right after this brief message from some of the folks that helped make the podcast possible.
Would groceries delivered to you in as fast as 1 hour save you a trip to the store? Instacart makes that possible thanks to personal shoppers in your area who hand-select items based on your preferences from the stores you love. And shopping multiple stores is possible on a single order. Instacart picks the freshest produce and even keeps your eggs safe, all while finding everything you usually buy, providing smart suggestions for new items, and even highlighting deals to help you save money. And now you get free delivery on your first order over $35. Let Instacart know we sent you and help support our show by following the link in the show notes. Instacart, groceries delivered in as fast as 1 hour.
We are in the three-headed version today of the A Fork in time travel what-if machine. One of us is sitting in the sidecar, and if you don't know who's sitting in the sidecar, it's like that poker thing, it might be you. I think I'm the guy sitting in the sidecar. Joined today by Chris Coppola, our regular contributor. Alexis is along for the ride today in the co-hosting chair. as we set up before we went into the break, we're talking about a historical what if that was suggested by one of our listeners regarding the 1956 Suez Crisis. And you know, the brief summary there is it's called a couple of different things. It could also be referred to as the Second Arab-Israeli War. It's sometimes called the Tripartite Aggression. The Sinai War. It's the situation is in 1956 that there's an invasion of Egypt by Israel that's followed by the United Kingdom and France stepping in. And the area of interest is the Suez Canal, incredibly important because it shortens the shipping distance, obviously, between all of Europe and all of Asia. And also, very importantly, during this period of time, that's how oil flows back and forth, which is obviously of incredible importance. And so what does happen is this, as a result of General Nasser, who is the Egyptian leader, he nationalizes the canal, which had been owned by the British and French before. And the British and French response to that is to basically issue an ultimatum, have a ceasefire, and then they land paratroopers in the canal zone. So things are looking like they have the potential of escalating here pretty quickly. And so the reference by Jacob, our listener, in terms of where we look at the fork here is the Eisenhower administration in the real timeline intervened. And they intervened. Well, Chris, do you want to describe the intervention? We were talking about it off podcast. And again, we would refer listeners to some episode of The Crown in case they need to see it dramatized for them. But they intervened in a unique way because they sort of did it using economic muscle and not military muscle.
Right. Basically, after the two world wars, Britain had sold a lot of bonds to finance the wars. And the United States basically went to Great Britain during this crisis in the months leading up to the actual invasion. Great Britain had talked to the United States, had tried to solicit involvement from them, and the United States said, absolutely not. We are doing our own thing in the Middle East. We have our own friends over there. We don't particularly want to be seen in the world as propping up imperial powers. So if you get cute, we'll sell your bonds and crash your economy.
And how effective was that?
Did we actually get that endorsement from the Crown? I don't want to do any spoilers. it was effective. It was very effective.
Right. And it also was, you know, I guess the other thing to mention here, and again, part of the reason I like having Chris along for these rides, Chris' knowledge of history is varied and deep, is that this was an important moment in British history. In fact, that's one of the reasons, obviously, that it's portrayed upon the Crown. This was sort of the end of Britain as a major world power after this event. After being shut down on going in and doing this, that sort of ended their role for that. So that's one of the reasons that it's important. But it was also an important moment for Nasser in terms of Nasser's position in the Arab world. Would you agree with that, Chris?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what does Nasser get out of this in the real timeline?
His face on TV screens across the world. He basically, this provided him the opportunity to be the face of Arab Republican nationalism. And he used that to basically start his own proxy thing all over the Middle East in terms of supporting the Algerian rebels, which was one of the reasons France got involved, in terms of supporting the civil war in Yemen, in terms of influencing events in Syria and Lebanon, into Jordan, in terms of backing the secular Republican governments that came to power in Iraq that turned in Saddam Hussein. All of those things kind of can trace their origins back to Nasser's success in their view, standing up to the West.
Just standing up to the West as a force?
Standing up to the West, standing up to Israel, basically that, hey, we're the connection to the Soviet Union. We can get weapons. We are a way that basically the Middle East can matter. can affect its own future rather than just being cut up into these different nice polygons by people in Europe who have no idea, you know, what these lines are cutting through.
Right. In fact, that's, you know, that's, I think, the number one thing when I think back on just colonialism in general is that you create these artificial lines on a map that aren't where natural divisions exist among cultures and peoples. And then you wonder why things don't work.
Countries don't get along.
Right. Because the country you created was never a country to begin with. And the people that you have inside the country or in the adjacent country, because of where the lines have been drawn, you know, fall into that category. It's especially true of the Middle East. It's especially true of Africa. Not that it didn't happen elsewhere in the world. In fact, it happened everywhere. It happened in Asia. It happened in South and Latin America as well. But it's particularly noticeable very often in the way that we still deal with those issues in the Middle East, and we deal with them in Africa, particularly today, from the colonial powers that were there. Of course, the other thing that's also going on behind the scenes here is, you know, Nasser has another big thing that he's trying to do, which is the Aswan High Dam project. And in some ways there, part of the reason for the way the U.S. chose to intervene is this is the Cold War. This is in the period of the Cold War continuing to build and being in its crescendo. The U.S. is concerned about the Soviets becoming involved in sponsoring that dam project and not some other thing. And so this is Egypt straddling, geopolitically straddling the East and West in a way that sort of is an interesting scenario. So again, gives a lot of visibility to Nasser among the Arabs and among the Arab community, but it also puts him in the middle of global politics because of the canal and the high dam situation. So exploring the first of those options, Chris, let's talk about the U.S. just sort of wholeheartedly supports it. Can you actually see that being a realistic opportunity? And if so, how would that play out in terms of how that what if would have gone along?
I see it as pretty disastrous for the U.S. Pretty problematic. The whole time I'm thinking about this, I'm drawing a parallel to another part of the world where we did militarily go in and pick up the mantle of the colonial power, that being Southeast Asia, and that did not work out.
And basically this is about the same time frame, thinking about the French Indochina and what's going on here. These are contemporary events.
This is literally the French pulled out of Indochina 2 years before this. And this is right at the point that the United States is making the commitment to support a post-colonial regime with very close ties to the French. And so, you know, if you look at, you know, what the United States did, I feel like not supporting what the United States did. I feel like if the United States would have supported this overtly, openly, it would have caused the United States problems throughout the Third World. Because like you talked about, this is just the very beginnings of decolonization. And if the United States is there as the new, the Soviets already are going to sell us as the new colonial power, but if we provide them the marketing material,
right,
that's going to make it that much harder for us.
Right. It's hard to claim that you're not when you're acting like you are, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, in both instances here, in the case of the English position and also the French position, they're protecting their previous colonial interests to some degree, the economic interest of the canal. I mean, the French were heavily involved in doing that as well as the British, but primarily the French. And so it's, you can understand what their motivation is. I mean, that's their asset. I mean, you know, I tried to draw the parallel in my head to what would have happened if a Panamanian leader had done something similar to the Panama Canal, for example, you know, would be the other equivalent. The U.S. would not have stood kindly by for that after what had happened there. So it's easy to understand the English and the French, you know, position on things. But again, I agree with you. If the United States had overtly stepped in a way, I think that would have been it would not have been limited to just a Suez crisis, I think is the easiest way that I know how to describe it. This would have become, emblematic of a whole bunch of things that were going on around the world and would have been problematic as a result of being emblematic. Fair enough?
Yes, I agree.
And I'll look over to Alexis. This predates her, so it's a little bit unfair to throw her in the midst of this. Although England is involved,
yes,
so she should have at least a fighting interest in what's going on here. What do you remember about? We were talking about the Crown here. It's okay to reference it. What do you remember about that particular episode of the Crown?
A couple things. I remember Nasser, because at that point it's Anthony Eden who's the prime minister, so he's the one who has to go to Egypt and deal with Nasser. And Nasser puts Eden in his place multiple times. Nasser is very he knows how to talk his way around things. that's definitely what I remember, and I'm also having a flashback to, there's a huge picture of Queen Elizabeth on the wall because it's owned by British interests, and that I have a visual of that picture being taken down mid anarchy, chaos. Are those two strong words?
Yeah, which to me is sort of emblematic or again symbolic of this. This is that representation of, this is the last throes of England as a global, you know. The definition of superpower was changing as a result of the nuclear age. And there were lots of reasons why prior to World War II, Great Britain is a superpower. The sun never sets on the empire, the imperial nature of what's there. Remembering that one of Elizabeth's other titles is, you know, Empress in addition to being queen. But this is, again, a symbolic nature of sort of the end of that era, which had already come to an end. To a great degree, but it was just recognizing, oh yeah, it really has come to an end. So I can certainly see that. So then the second thing we talked about, Chris, was the idea where the U.S. is not overtly supportive, but just sort of is laissez-faire about it. So under that scenario, the thing that jumps into my mind there is that's also dangerous and unlikely, because to not do anything when you could have intervened would have been the recognition that, very much like what would actively doing something in support would have been, to not oppose this in some way would have at least been giving a rubber stamp to continuing colonialism, even if you weren't actively engaged in it.
And the other question I have, you know, we kind of touched on this a little bit, and we're going to touch on it in Fork 3, but I kind of, my question to both of you would be, okay, if we approve a occupation of the Suez Canal, in my research, this was one of the interesting things. The English, the commander of the British troops and the commander of the ground troops did not know what the goal of the operation was.
Right.
Was it to secure the canal, or was it to remove Nasser?
Right.
And you know, I think this is now, those of you that had emblematic on your bingo scorecard, I've now used it the third time, ding, 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 you should have a bingo by now. That's emblematic of a lot of what happened, again, in these situations where the superpowers were imposing themselves into things that were regional or local. It's, you know, what is the, you know, A, what is the objective? And then we get into the same thing later, you know, the U.S. getting into this and others getting this. What is the exit strategy? How do we know when we're done? Okay, so we've come to seize and hold the canal for a week, for a month, for a year, forever. You know, again, back to the question of what is the objective here, which I think you've clearly stated, was it solely around the asset, or was it around a bigger political question? And then when you go beyond that to a degree, then it turns into, so again, are we here for the short haul, or is there going to be a permanent occupation zone? That's a whole other place that it could have gone as well.
And actually, what wound up happening is the United States and the Soviet Union agreed to put in UN peacekeepers that area. And that actually might have been an acceptable solution, that this becomes an international zone. Getting back to the initial suggestion, those peacekeepers were ordered out in May of 67.
Right.
And that was one of the red flags that kind of you know, let Israel know something was coming.
Right. And if it, the way that I think of that, and this may be an incorrect way to think about it, is that, okay, we're taking the lid off the bottle again. Now we're letting the genie back out. And so we went from 56 to 67, but you know, all we did was push pause essentially on what happened there. Fun thing about this, the 67 and the subsequent things that happened there, when the canal is actually closed to traffic because of some of the activities of the war, there's some fun YouTube stuff. Again, another reference here to YouTube again, so maybe I'll try to find it. But it talks about the vessels that were sort of trapped there that couldn't leave. And so you had these crews that had to stay on the vessels to keep them in, you know, some reasonable order for when things were there. And at one point, they actually had an Olympic Games among the crews, the various international crews of the vessels that were trapped in transit on the canal. And of course, it was a big thing. I forget how long the canal was closed, but it was a long enough period of time that it became a notable disruption. The realization of why the canal got built in the first place was recognized again when suddenly you did not have the canal to use for transit. So we understand why it's strategically important. So again, I don't see as much of a difference between Fort Two, which is the sort of tacit, we're just going to let things be things, and the active thing. I don't think there's much difference between the two of them, just in terms of how they would have played out in terms of their net effect on what happens there. I think you get the same net effects, whether the U.S. is viewed as being just a villain or the party that just lets the others be the villain. At least from my perspective. Chris, do you have any different take on that other than what you sort of already said about, obviously, it doesn't bode well for the U.S. elsewhere in the world when they want to say something different, right?
Well, other than actively, part of me says this, other than actively being the villain, with Israel, France, and Britain actually doing the dirty work, you're going to get blamed for it anyway if you're the United States, unless you are above and beyond angry about this. And you know, like we talked about, unless you are willing to put the special relationship on the line and grab one of your closest allies and really hurt their economy.
Right.
Which is what they ended up, Eisenhower ended up being willing to do, because it was in the broader interest, is in the broader U.S. interest. I think he thought in his mind it was in the broader NATO and Western alliance interest to do this as well. He wasn't just looking out. He was looking out for what was good for the United States, but I think he was looking out more generally what was good for those that were opposing what was viewed to be the Soviets were doing or not doing, whether it was real or imagined at that particular point in time. So I guess we talked about the third fork, and the third fork was, I'm trying to remember now, the third fork was basically doing what, Chris? Remind me.
Basically, you've been approached, if you're Eisenhower or Dulles, you've been approached by Great Britain and France saying, we need to do something, so you say we can do something, just not overt occupation.
Right, and so there we talking about the types of things that are covert intelligence matters of where you're looking to destabilize the regime. So the way that we will deal with this is it's not about the canal at that point. It's about Nasser as a leader. It's about who's going to lead in Egypt. And we were talking off podcast about one of the dangerous things about doing that type of thing is you may get somebody different, but it may not be the somebody different you thought you were going to get.
Or, you know, frankly, it may be somebody who you want right now, and
right,
things are going to change down the line, and you don't want that person anymore.
Right. And it's not like there's not several hundred thousand, it feels like, examples of that from history. There's certainly several dozen examples during the Cold War of where I think both the United States and the Soviet Union would point to and say, yeah, we thought we were getting this, but we got that.
Yeah. Or frankly, to take it back to the Second World War, we wanted the Soviet Union. We wanted a powerful Soviet Union. As soon as Nazi Germany was removed, we had a powerful Soviet Union. Now what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
then we realized we actually didn't want that.
Right. Well, you just that the circumstances changed, and now you don't. But you just can't wish away what you built or what you created at the particular time. And so one of the things we were talking about in terms of Nasser's, what Nasser got out of the real what did here, sort of his stature in the Arab world. And again, we're working here off of a listener suggestion, so I want to make sure that we're very clear about that. So his question is, how would this have played out for Egyptian politics? So let's make sure we go down that path. So what are the pros and cons to Nasser about some of these different forks and what actually did happen here?
The pro to Nasser, let me be clear, the pro to the United States for leaving Nasser, or pro to who? I guess that's kind of my first question.
I think that is the
question. That's a fair question.
I think that is the question. Exactly that.
Okay.
I think Nasser gets some standing, obviously, in the Arab community in the real historical what did. So if you look at some of these other historical what ifs, does that lessen Nasser's role? Let's assume that they don't go down the path of destabilizing his regime with, you know, covert activities and protests and some of the other things that are there. If the English and French and Israeli aggression had stood, where does that leave Nasser under that scenario? Internally out of Egypt, and I guess externally in the Arab world, are the two parts to that question.
I would say, all right, let's do it again. The crown, Argentina. He's basically tried to reach out and gotten his hand slapped and has had to give up a major strategic resource of Egypt. That's going to lead to internal destabilization. Basically, Nasser was a colonel who had overthrown the Egyptian monarchy 4 years before and was now calling himself the leader of the entire Arab world. 4 years before this, he was a colonel. He was nobody. And this helps solidify and give him those nationalist bona fides. And if he's left, if the commander comes down and is told to just occupy the canal and he's left, I don't think he's around that long.
And so what rises up in the place of a Nasser, again, assuming, let's say, fork one or fork two, what rises up in Nasser's place? Because I can see that breaking one of two ways, or both.
Well, there's one way, which is you find another colonel.
Right.
A colonel who's willing to play ball with you. In fact, the United States and the British actually had contact with Nasser's group, the Free Officer Movement, before their revolution in 52, and had given them some support because they were afraid the king was going to nationalize the canal. The king of Egypt, Farouk, had a very, very tempestuous relationship with the English, to the point that during the war they had basically put him under house arrest because he was making very friendly noises about Italy and Nazi Germany. So initially, the French and the British are a little concerned, and the United States are concerned about the king, so we picked an officer to put in charge. And kind of your, all right, that officer didn't work. We can always find another one.
There's more than one colonel, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Pick a colonel, any colonel.
Yeah. Yes, and keep picking one until you find one who's willing to play ball with you.
Right. So I think that is certainly one possibility. I just can't easily find a scenario there where this, a different scenario is somehow you move over to more of a true democratic Egypt coming out of the backside of this in any way. I think the nature of the culture and what the politics had been up to this point is it is finding a successor strongman, be he a colonel, be he a general, go down and find the sergeant if he's the right one, right? But putting that in place, I find it very difficult that it breaks in the other direction, although I guess that's a possibility, is that somehow, you know, somebody could have risen up out of that circumstance who would not have had, again, the word in my mind, which is loaded, I know it's loaded, strongman tendencies. You know, somehow this produces a different type of scenario there, because that just wasn't the background, that just wasn't the context of the time period that we're talking about, at least in my mind. So if it's not Nasser, it's going to be somebody Nasser-esque. And that's a question of, is it a Western-leaning Nasser-esque or is it a Soviet-leaning Nasser-esque? And both sides are trying to find, you know, then you get competing colonels. That's the other way that this plays out.
There's one more possibility.
There's always the third rail. What's the third rail, Chris?
The Brotherhood.
The Brotherhood.
The Muslim Brotherhood was organizing in Egypt at this point. They had kind of been involved in supporting the Free Officers coup in 52, and then they were on the out. Basically, you're right in that, you know, for the longest time, the Egyptian government had been basically worried about the canal and the British. Nowhere in there did I talk about schools or hospitals or sewers, or all of the day-to-day city council stuff that builds a relationship between people and their government.
Right.
And that gap had been filled by the Muslim Brotherhood. And they were a group that could have had enough popular legitimacy to have gotten a non-military government there.
Very different than what we see post the regular crisis, though, in terms of how that would play out in the geopolitics of the region, no doubt.
Very, very different. And this was, you know, this is getting the whole idea of what I was talking about previously of, hey, we like them now, we may not like them in the future. The very mention of that name probably, it conjures up certain things in any American today who's, you know, been like world affairs aware, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm thinking about one of the things we talked about off podcast and I haven't brought up yet was what happened in Persia, Iran 2 years before. Basically, there had been a nationalizing prime minister, a man by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, and he wanted to seize the Anglo-Iranian oil company facility down in Abadan. In the British eyes, that made him a communist, and the British worked with the United States and created enough chaos in that country that people basically decided the prime minister, Mossadegh, was behind all the chaos and had to go. And lo and behold, as soon as he got rid of him and brought in the, you know, autocratic, brought back the autocratic Shah, the anarchy stopped. And first, that was one of the first times that the United States and Great Britain worked together in terms of achieving a political goal in the third world, basically outside of a world war. So that's one of the things that's kind of in my mind when we're discussing our third option of something that could have abetted this crisis. Somebody tries to nationalize a critical infrastructure and the United States and Great Britain work together to make sure that they stop threatening that.
Right. So under, again, getting back to our listeners' questions, I want to be faithful and loyal to what the original exercise was here. So the conclusion on that is, would we likely have seen, if there had been a different role played by the Eisenhower administration, any of the scenarios that we've had here, do we still end up with something like the wars in 67 and 73, and then ultimately getting down to, you know, what leads to Camp David Accords, where we actually get, you know, the first version of some land for peace that happens in the Middle East. is that inevitable, I guess, becomes my question. Obviously, the timing probably changes and the role players probably change a little bit, but could that have been avoided if there had been a different way that the situation is handled in 56, will we not find ourselves in 67? Spoiler alert here, I think you've already mentioned the fact that when peacekeepers were removed, what happened? So I think I know the answer to the question, but do you have any different thoughts on that, Chris?
Well, I did mention what happens when the peacekeepers are removed, but keep in mind the peacekeepers that we have there were put in under very, very different circumstances than what they could be with what we're discussing. If it's an international zone, if the Suez is an international zone and the peacekeepers are there, and let's assume, and this is a big assumption, but let's assume that we have a chastened Nasser that has been able to hold on to power. Under option two, or one where we do have an international canal zone, he doesn't have the respect, he doesn't have the authority, he doesn't have the political capital to snap his fingers and move these troops.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's one issue. The other thing is, if you have the Suez, if you have the Sinai as something that is physically cut off from mainland, can we call it Egypt? That changes the Egyptian hold there. That changes their ability to shut the Straits of Tirana, which are down towards the south of the Sinai Peninsula, basically the only way to access Eilat, which is a southern Israeli port.
Right.
So that changes it in a material way. The other thing is, if you don't have Nasser having his heft, having his popularity, I think the other issue is you don't have the clear Arab unity that you did in our timeline. Basically, in, I believe it was 1962, Egypt and Syria joined and became the same country. They formed what was called the United Arab Republic. And so, looking at the Israeli issue, they always have this understanding that as soon as anything happens, everything happens.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Everybody is coming in at the same time. If you look at what they did in 67, the way they were able to survive and win was Egypt first, and let's just have everybody else just hold on, white knuckle, and survive long enough for us to finish off Egypt, and then we can come back and settle everybody else's hash. Israel's in a much safer position if the Arab frontline states are divided, aren't united behind Nasser.
Right.
Right.
It changes the dynamics of how many you're facing and who you're facing in terms of the situation. And like you said, can you deal with individual circumstances one by one versus collectively and what that means? And if you look back, in some ways, I feel like I'm trotting gently here, because this is a difficult part of the world to generalize anything about. It's a dangerous part of the world to get too generalized about, even inside of the sides of that conflict. But part of the reason that it's complicated is it's complicated. My dad once said to me, son, the reason that's complicated is it's complicated. If it were simple, it wouldn't be complicated. And, part of the reason that, peace in the Middle East is complicated is as simple as it's complicated, because it has, when are, for example, the interests of Egypt and Syria aligned, and when are they not aligned at various points, or other powers in the East? What is the relationship between those entities? Do they share always the common interest? And the answer is no. And because of that, there are things that they have in common, but that doesn't always mean that they're willing to go lockstep together. To me, that also goes back to the whole situation that we're talking about here in 56. I think to some degree, if you were the British or the French in this whole exercise of the Suez exercise, you sort of didn't expect the response that you got from the United States for all kinds of reasons, because you thought you were in law, but no, there were different interests there, and that's a different way that it was going to play out. I think the same is true inside of the Arab world. And, you know, ultimately, I think there was always going to be conflict. Also, I think there was always going to be the genesis for the things that have led to, it certainly doesn't feel like peace in the Middle East, but we've had a relatively stable, peaceful Middle East overall for 50 years in terms of it breaking out into all, in terms of breaking out versus the type of war that it used to break out in 48, 67, and 73. I guess you can make that argument, right?
You could, except that the fact is that in 48 and 56 and 67 and 73, and let's go ahead and throw in 82, what all of the frontline states confronting Israel realized is, I'm not sure what tense to use at this point, you can't confront them in a set piece conventional battle. Russian tanks are not going to do it for you.
Right.
Yeah. And so they found other ways to try and win.
With varying degrees of success / failure.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So, Alexis, did you have any questions or thoughts that sort of, I know this is not your area of absolute expertise or fun, and we recognize that, and I don't want to have you be mentalized here, but is there anything that's running through your head, just sort of taking a different maybe view on this than Chris and I do, or thinking about it in a different way?
Well, we touched on Israel, and we were talking about it off podcast, and my immediate response to the Muslim Brotherhood and how that would play out for Israel is that was bad. It never occurred to me that if you have the Muslim Brotherhood coming into power and you know, being a force to be reckoned with, that actually is in some ways better for Israel, because they're fighting one united instead of these. So that was an interesting way to think about it that I hadn't thought about before. So I did want to Give Chris some props on that one, because I hadn't thought about that for sure.
Literally, if you look at the Middle East today, look at the split within what is today's Palestinian Authority. You have Hamas, which is Islamic fundamentalist, which are generally the intellectual children, can we call them, of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you have Fatah and other more secular nationalist groups, which are in charge of, sorry, I forgot to mention Hamas in the Gaza Strip and Fatah in the West Bank. And at one point, they were more interested in fighting each other than they were right. Israeli soldiers.
Right.
Well, and even a way that this plays out today, and you see this portrayed in a lot of ways in the last couple of years, Iran versus Saudi Arabia, in terms of, you know, there you're talking about Sunni versus Shia elements that go on as well. Again, I think very often to the naive American political observer, well, it's all the same. No, it's not. And in fact, they, as you will point out, they would be more inclined. They are fighting a proxy war against each other in Yemen now. I mean, that's literally what's going on there. It's this idea of a united, that again, that what it means to be Arab is all united under one thing is simply not true anymore. So then there are two different parties in Israel, for example, that have some different ideas about how to approach things, just like there are different ideas in the United States and every other nation in the world that goes on. And of course, the other thing that jumped out at me is just, you know, you mentioned that subtle thing about part of the reason that the Brotherhood was able to gather some of the support that it had was it dealt with local issues far better than some of the pan-Arab and nationalistic issues. You know, you see that by both Western powers, you know, how do you win the hearts and minds of people? Well, it's simple things like fresh water and sanitation and
food,
you know, making sure that children are educated. You see that to some degree, certainly inside the Islamic world today, where there's success there because of, you know, bringing education and schools and other things to bear. And, it's, you know, as we've often talked about, maybe this is a good way to sort of bring the episode to a close. When we want to talk about, you know, history and the what ifs, we want to talk about the big things of history. And, you know, somewhere in Egypt, had this gone out differently, there may have been somebody who would have had, you know, picked the small little interest there that could have come from, you know, a rise of, like you mentioned, the Brotherhood situation where, you know, somebody's got better water. Somebody's got a school to send somebody to. Somebody has, you know, access to something else. That's not where we go, you know, what if history podcast very often, but that's the reality of what sometimes changes in some of these things.
And, you know, one of the things I grappled with when we started thinking about this was the idea of, and I know how rosy a scenario this is, and that's why I didn't like it, but the United States going in and building the dam and helping to provide all of those services, which, you know, we didn't at this point, but we were very close to founding a Peace Corps and doing things like that and turning Egypt into a developed state where people have concerns other than what a strong man is shouting at them through a megaphone. And if you're providing for regular needs, you kind of maybe don't feel the need to go take out other people around you. But that was just entirely too rosy for me to actually suggest.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's also not as simple as that. You know, that's right. That's the other reality that exists too. That, again, back to my dad's statement about the reason it's complicated is it's complicated. If it really were that easy, it would have already been done, kind of thing. So, all right. Well, Chris, again, good to have you back in your role here as regular contributor. As we're drawing here towards the end of 2020, we're glad you're able to join Alexis and I today, and we'll be doing this more frequently, even if it's all done virtually. And so I know that I've already received a couple of comments back from some of our listeners about they're excited about Chris joining in a regular role, and so it's good to see that as well. So, Chris, before we sort of sign off, anything you want to bring us up to speed on or up to date on that maybe listeners may care about?
Nothing in particular, no, not I can think of.
Well, and Alexis and I were talking earlier about some of the episodes that she and I recorded earlier today. As we transition here from 2020, this episode, I think, will be released in early 2021. We're hoping, you know, 2021 has to be better, right? It just has to be better,
don't.
Right?
Yeah, don't go there.
Think about, look at my background. Yeah. It could get worse.
It could get worse.
All right, then.
Yeah, and of course, the good news is that we are seeing the vaccine starting to roll out, at least in parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we can continue to see things down that line. So again, Chris, thanks for joining us. Lex, anything you want to say before we close things out?
Think you covered everything.
Yeah, I think we managed to put blindfolds on and successfully navigate the cable a little bit here, which is, if we can do that, we set a threshold that we were looking to beat for an episode. I won't reference that. We've definitely more than done that. So we'll pick that up from there. Alexis is rolling her eyes at me as I say that too, which is fair enough as well. I guess we close out. I just want to remind folks that we do have the website. We did some revisions here to the website over the holidays. So if you haven't been to www.AForkInTimePodcast, the A is important. The podcast is important to get to the right place. I invite you to go there. If you haven't been, you won't know that it's changed. So shame on you. If you have been, you'll know that it's changed. But we've added some new things that are there, and you'll hear more about those coming in the next couple of weeks. And so we just invite you to go there. And again, this episode was spawned by the idea of a listener putting in a suggestion. So if you want to hear us pontificate for about an hour on something that wasn't our idea originally, you too can cause that to happen. You just go there and fill out a form, and you'll be amazed at what might happen as a result of that. So we certainly encourage that as well. So on behalf of Alexis and on behalf of Chris, I'm going to go ahead and close out the podcast today and just remind you guys that our suggestion is that if you encounter a fork in time, what do you think we ought to do, Lex?
Take it.
All right. Thanks, guys. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. Learn more about the podcast at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Join us next time.